Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists.
I'm Daniel Legree, your host, and our guest today is Laura Petrovich Cheney. Laura is a sculptor whose work mirrors the human experience, full of transformation, second chances, reinvention, and resilience. She's also a Clark Hulings Fund 2015 Business Accelerator Grant recipient for her current solo exhibition at Salisbury University Art Galleries, Piece by Piece. Laura, welcome. We know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about your background and what you do for a living?
Sure. Thank you very much for having me on the show today. I am a sculptor, but I've also been a fashion designer, an art teacher, a college professor, a painter, as well as a sculptor. Right now, I love working with wood, and that is my primary medium, so I identify myself as a sculptor.
So, Laura, what inspired you to use salvage materials to create your quilts and other art? I hear you saying use wood, but a lot of that wood is reclaimed.
Correct. All the wood is reclaimed. I love believing in random chances. So in 2010, on a walk during the beach after a huge nor'easter, I found two boats. They were kind of beat up and quite a mess. So I picked them up, hauled them in the truck, and brought them back to my studio. And within about a year, I started to work on them and cut them up into small pieces. And the pieces were so reminiscent of a quilt that I'd seen in a magazine. So I just sort of laid them out, much like a quilt pattern, and had this great idea to put them on the wall. A lot of modern quilts and antique quilts are hung on the wall. Some quilts are obviously functional, but a lot of them that are more considered art are put on the wall. So it just kind of made sense as a quilter to do the same thing with the salvaged wood. And then in the fall of 2013, with the hurricane, it just was a plethora of material. And it was a real personal experience, since I lived through Hurricane Sandy, to take the salvaged wood that was littered all over my community and the surrounding area and just piece things back together.
So it's a lovely way to interface with a time and a place and an event in your own life as well. I have to say, when you were saying you walked along, I found two goats. And then when you said you carved them up, I was like, oh, that doesn't sound like what she meant. But what are the difficulties? Those poor goats. So what are the difficulties in working with large pieces and reclaimed materials like that?
The hardest part of the reclaimed material are the hidden nails. I really have to search through the nails quite a bit to make sure I don't cut them accidentally. So that's a big search. The other hard thing with the salvaged wood is that it's so beat up. I mean, when you see images of Hurricane Sandy along the Jersey coast and how everything was just bent and torn, I'm really working with wood that no longer is straight. So the equipment that I use, I have to be extremely careful. Like, for example, I can't use a table saw because the wood is bowed and warped. So I have to cut it into small pieces, much like large pieces of fabric. If you can imagine pieces of fabric getting cut into smaller pieces to build the quilt, I sort of do the same thing with the wood. I have to cut it down into smaller pieces and run it through a bandsaw. And it's just such a great process because the two of the processes of sewing and making the quilts are so similar, whether it's fabric or wood for me. You know, you start off with large pieces of material and they get smaller and smaller, and then they get pieced back together in larger and larger squares.
So you said that this particular exhibition, and also especially the stuff that derives from Sandy, has a lot of personal meaning to you. But I wonder, to what degree does some sense of social consciousness influence your choice of exhibitions or performances? Is it social consciousness or is it something else?
It's both. I mean, quilts have been markers for personal and community narratives. So it's personal in that I was affected by the storm. It's also a show of how communities have been affected. It's kind of a commentary on these larger superstorms that happen. So So it's really a culmination of a couple of things. And yes, it is a conscious commentary on the superstorms. And the amount of garbage that got collected and sent into landfills was just absolutely incredible. I mean, three-story high parking lots filled with garbage. I mean, these piles were immense. And to think that every time there is a superstorm, whether it's from a tornado or a hurricane or a landslide, you think about all the houses that are destroyed and all that material has to go somewhere. And it's filling up. And the destruction and the cost of the destruction is mind-boggling. And it is a social commentary on that. It's also a commentary on what happens to a community, how it gets ripped apart, both physically. The houses now have been demolished. Some lots have been sold. The people have moved on. And it's just amazing how we're so affected by these things.
Now, for those who can't picture your work, and I encourage you to Google Laura's name so that you can get an idea of what she does. These are wooden quilts. This is reclaimed wood from the storms that essentially forms a quilt and hangs on the wall. So in that sense, it's not textile art. It's very interesting. I wonder, you talked about the overall cost of the storm damage, etc. So I'm going to ask you a question about cost. So how do you pursue this sort of personal and social inspiration that you have? How do you pursue the muse while at the same time making a real living from your art?
Actually, there's a couple of things. I sell the pieces. They are personal, but I feel that they do belong out into the world because it was a collective experience. So I sell the larger pieces, but I also have this, I make these smaller pieces that are about 12 inches square, and they sell for much less. And people that don't have a lot of money or aren't sure about investing in art can pick up my 12-inch squares for just about $100. And that I make a lot of those. I sell them at the gift shops at museums. I sell them at the gift shop at my alma mater, Moore College of Art. And so I sell them frequently and often sort of, they're wonderful. It's a steady income to have these smaller pieces. They're much more accessible to a larger audience, and that helps sustain my income. I also teach college as well, and part of teaching college is another source of income that I derive from, as well as exhibiting at universities. They offer stipends to speak and work with their students. So for me, that's fantastic as well, because I really enjoy teaching and meeting other artists and sort of giving them a pathway to say, yeah, this is a viable career, this is an exciting career, and I'm doing it, and hopefully you can find some inspiration from me and continue on the tradition of being a thriving and practicing artist.
Well, I love two things about what you said. I mean, I think that's probably one of the best answers I've ever gotten to a question like that, and for a couple of reasons. One is, it's brilliant. You're making your art accessible economically, as well as just visually. We can own your art, not just come and see it. And you've almost productized it in a way. You can buy in at any level. It's not an exclusivity that is driving your career. It's accessibility. It's the opposite end. So you're really responding to the market and seeing who your potential audience is, and producing art that that feeds that audience at any level. And I think, man, that's smart. But the other thing is that, you've discovered something that it's taken probably a lot of non-artists. I think all artists know this, but a lot of non-artists have taken 40, 50 years to discover this. We used to think that security came from getting one job and keeping it all your life and retiring with that company and they give you a gold pen. And that hasn't been true in quite some time. And sort of the new security comes from having multiple income streams, multiple irons in the fire, and ways to circle the thing that you care about and achieve an income from it. And artists have always really kind of had to do that, but you are making that a fairly tight circle. You're producing multiple kinds of iterations of art, and also teaching and speaking within your career path. So I love that. I think that's amazing. What then is the biggest business or career challenge that you currently
face? Oh, there's kind of a lot of them. One is just documenting, like having systems to document the work, where it is in different exhibits, because frequently I'm not just in one exhibit, I'm in a couple others. You know, tracking where the work has been, the history of the piece. I think that's important for collectors to know that it's been shown at this, in this venue or that venue. So that's really difficult. It's just finding these systems to document the work and keeping track of it, sort of like an inventory list. You know, I don't have that for myself. And when you go and get an MFA, I think you should also get an MBA as well, because it's not easy tracking income and my spending and these little things that are part of a business that I never thought that I would take on as an artist. When you dream of, you know, making a living doing what you love to do, you never realize, like, oh my goodness, I have to keep track of my receipts. Are you kidding me? You know, these little things are a challenge. That's my biggest challenge right now. It's just maintaining the business of it.
Well, you're talking our language at the Clark Healings Fund, of course. You know, we want to equip artists with a whole tool set. And among those, you know, we have tools like Artwork Archive that we bestow upon our finalists and winners of our grant process, as well as provide a discount to pretty much any other artist to obtain. And tools like that help you not only track where your art is, you know, who has it out, but also the commission sales of the art and gallery revenue, as well as give you a way to display the art virtually so that you can actually get more shows, etc. So we're right there with you,
right,
acknowledging that this type of tool set is so critical for artists to make the next step in their career jump. Let me ask you, so what impact is the current project that you're on? I mean, this is a project funded by the Clark Healings Fund. What impact is that having on your career, this show?
It's given me, the grant has been amazing. I could not have done this show without the grant. It allowed me to purchase more materials, to make new pieces for this work. It allowed me to fund the transportation of this work to Maryland, not only to install the show, but also to provide an opportunity to be with the students. It's several hours outside my state. It's pretty far. I mean, it's about 4 hours. So I'm thrilled that it's given me the opportunity to expand into the tri-state area, not just locally in New Jersey where I'm from, but to begin to broaden my horizons and my opportunities as an artist and to reach a new audience. So without the grant, I could not have done this, or I would have suffered greatly financially from not having the grant support me. So I am so grateful for that, because expanding the message of what I do is important for me and for my business.
I think that's really an important point, that aside from the specific things that you needed as an artist to make the next jump, it's really that you're attempting in the first place to build a sustainable business, a sustainable career path, and that there are critical points in doing that for every artist, no matter where they are, that it helps that you have some sense of what your career is, what you need to do next, and that you, I mean, obviously we give these grants to people that have a very clear plan and can spell it out for us so that we understand that this is a business investment. But I think that's a brilliant point, that you have this pivotal moment when the funding makes all the difference. So what was it? What inspired you exactly to apply for the grant? Was it that you, at the time, you needed the travel, you needed the need for materials to do the show? Was there something else that got your attention? What grabbed you about it, if anything?
Well, first of all, I really personally love the story of Clark Hewlins. He had been an illustrator for a number of years, and then he became an easel painter at 40. I went back to school at 41 years old for my MFA. I had previously worked as a fashion designer for a number of years and an elementary art teacher, but I always, always wanted that degree, the Master's of Fine Arts. I think it really defined such a huge point in my life when I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be an artist. And I felt that that degree gave me sort of that credential and credibility, not only in my mind, but in the art world as well. And I really liked Clark Hewlins because he did the same thing almost at the same age. And, you know, you think about changing careers midlife and like, wow, it took a lot of courage. And for me, that was really exciting. And I admire his work and his bravery to do that at 40. So for me, there was his person, his career kind of resonated with my life.
You know, I'm really glad you brought up Clark because, I mean, obviously that's central to our mission. We say on the very front of ClarkHewlingsFund.org that we want artists to be like Clark Hewlings, as skilled at their business as they are at their craft. And we point out that while Clark Hewlings never stopped pursuing his own artistic development, his muse, his growth as a creative person, he always understood that he was running a business and that he needed to produce economic return and contribute to the overall economy. So, you know, that's really the unique mission of the Clark Hewlings Fund is to help artists contribute to the overall economy, build, say, self-sustaining businesses so that we can fill the world with art. So I, you know, you are very representative of what we are trying to achieve. So let me ask you, where do you see your art career and your business as an artist in, say, 10 years?
Ooh, you know, I love setting goals. I think that's really pivotal in anyone's life, whether they're an artist or musician or anything. And I love to plan backwards. You know, planning backwards was instrumental with my teaching. You know, what do the kids want to learn at the end of the year and then kind of work that way. So seeing my career in 10 years is planning backwards. And it's really comfortable for me to think about and dream about. But I would like to continue my work. I love combining textiles and women's art. And what I mean by women's art is the traditional notions of needlework, sewing, quilting with new and unusual materials particularly that are reclaimed and recycled, whether I'm knitting with plastics or, you know, quilting with scrap wood, these things. And I'd like to continue that on a larger level in more prestigious museums, gallery representation, as well as university shows. For me, university art galleries are so essential to teaching the next generation of artists. I think, like Clark Hewlins, it's professional artists, when they go to schools, model for the next generation. You know, I'd like them to see that I am a practicing and working artist, and that kind of inspiration I like to share a lot, because that's how I learned about things when I went back to school, from looking at other working artists. How do they do it? How are they making ends meet? Learning from them. So I want to give back, and that's what I hope in 10 years to be doing. You know, having the university shows, speaking with the students, and just giving back.
I love that answer. I want to ask you, in keeping with this notion that we treat our art as a business, you have this show. It's in Maryland. You're coming from mm-hmm. New Jersey. And we're going to talk more at the end of the show about where this is located and why people need to attend and tell anybody they know in Maryland to attend. But what are you doing to promote the show? As part of a business, of course, marketing is critical. What type of marketing, what type of promotion?
That's a great question. I work really hard before the show, not just making the work, but researching the whole community. Since I know this body of work is inspired by quilts, I reach out to several quilt communities. I just go online and Google quilt guilds, quilt groups, get their names and their addresses. I send them information. I email them. I do the same thing with state art councils. Anybody can go to the state art council websites and find local art guilds, contact them, send out flyers, mailers, emails, as well as schools, particularly high schools, any community colleges in the area. All these groups receive my emails, as well as the local paper. I Google the town's local paper, the county paper, the state paper, contact all of those, find out who is the writer at the local paper that covers the arts events. Eventually, if it's picked up locally, it may get picked up by the county, eventually the state. So I do a ton of marketing prior to the show and getting that word out myself. And people love to receive personal emails, so I email certain groups as well and invite them to the show, invite them to my talk. If they can't make it to the opening, I invite them and make myself accessible at other times to meet with them. And that's such a great marketing tool that I do to promote community involvement in the show. It's a lot of work, but it's so effective. And it's effective because I'm building relationships with the people in that area.
So we've talked about some of the core areas of business operation. Successful art careers are obviously built with talent and hard work, but also, as we say at the Clark Healings Fund, business acumen, training, financial support at crucial moments, and we're talking about the marketing component, which is critical. But what do you say, Laura, to people who say, you know, I'm an artist. I don't want to think about marketing. I shouldn't have to think about marketing. This is not what I want. I'm in this to create, not to get my hands dirty with self-promotion and PR and all of that. Do you have any insights? Do you agree? Would you agree with that perspective? Is it something you loathe, or is there something an artist should love about?
No, it is kind of weird when you do have to send out marketing stuff. It's more like sharing your story. I want to share my story in making the story of resilience and perseverance personal. It also becomes universal. When we really become vulnerable and share our story, we connect with others. And it's in that connection that we grow and learn from each other. So that's sort of how I approach it. I'm just here to tell my story. If someone calls that marketing, that's fine. But I want to hear other people's stories as well. And if I can connect with someone, they'll tell me their story. I'll share mine with them. We become friends, and then we grow and we learn from each other. And that's kind of how I think the world works, or how it should work. And that's how I approach my work, that I'm not selling a product. I'm telling you my story, and this is just a byproduct of it. And, you know, my story is about second chances and transformation and resilience. And if you want to hear it, that's great. If you don't, that's okay too. But, you know, when I'm done, I'd like to hear what you do. And most of the people that come out to art shows are interested in art, and they probably make art. And I love hearing their story as well. You know, I guess it just comes down to it that human beings are storytellers.
Well, I think we're putting our funding in the right place. When I hear you talk about this, marketing as sharing your story. I think of the person that opens a shop and bakes cookie, or, you know, makes hand churned ice cream or whatever it is. And I think, you know, I want to meet the guy behind the counter. I want to meet the person. There's a local popcorn place where somebody named Gene Tsai makes this wonderful gourmet popcorn that is always fresh, has this wonderful aroma in New York City. And you can actually go there and meet the lady who can tell you how she created this process and came up with the ideas for these recipes. And that makes it all the more personal. And that is marketing, but the fact that I can meet that person, but it's so important. I went out the other day to get a piece of apple pie. I'd seen a movie about what apple pie was like in the 1960s, and it was killing me. The guy's sitting in a diner, and he said, it's the best pie ever. And she's like, the waitress is like, I'll tell my mom who baked it this morning. I'm like, how do I get pie like that? So I go to this place, and I'm like, do you have apple pie? And they say, well, we have apple crumble. And I'm like, all right. So then they explain to me what crumble is, and I'm like, did you bake it here? And they're like, well, we have it brought in. I'm like, have it brought in? This doesn't sound right. Like, what's the story behind this pie? And what it's done is it's separated me from seeing the creation process and the people responsible for producing the thing that I'm going to put in my own body. And if I'm going to hang art on my wall, or I'm going to spend my time looking at art, I want to know something about it. I don't want to just bathe in ignorance and look at it and go, oh, that's an interesting picture or an interesting thing. I know nothing about it, but okay, there you go. It's like the apple crumble. What you're giving us is more like the 1960s home-baked pie. I wonder, can you give us some insight into, as a working artist who is successful, who's making a living, what does it really take to earn a living as an artist? What have you personally learned? What part, can you tell us that part of your story?
Sure. There is no separation of work and life anymore. And it's really interesting because I was reading an article about work and life. And prior to the Industrial Revolution, there was no separation of work and life. You know, people looked at farming for their food, not as work, but as a way to live, or shearing the sheep and cleaning the wool as a way to live, not necessarily work. Sort of how I think of my life, that I tell stories about my life through my work, and my work is me and I'm my work, and there's really no separation. And that also means that I'm always working. You know, Sunday afternoon, if I've got a couple of hours, I'm in the studio. It's Friday night. I have no plans. I might be upstairs on my computer or looking for opportunities. If I'm in the subway and I'm reading something, chances are I'm reading Art News or Sculpture Magazine. So it's always in my life. It's constant. And I think that's one of the things to do today, is that you better find out what you love to do, because to be successful at it, I think you always have to immerse yourself in it fully and passionately to be successful.
Wow. I think you've given us maybe something along the lines of the title of our episode, No Separation Between Work and Life. That is superb. So let me ask you some questions that we often ask when we have artists on the show. And for our listeners that have been longtime listeners of the show, you know, we have collectors, art industry experts, we have people involved in every aspect of the art process. And so artists are obviously a portion of that. We have art appraisers. I mean, you name it. So it's a privilege, really, to have you on, Laura, and be able to sort of pick your brain. Can you comment on has there been any shift in your view in the market or the industry today versus when you started out? Have you had to shift your game a little bit to be successful in this?
That's really an interesting question. I've only started in 2011. I mean, I've always painted, I've always drawn, and I've always wanted to be in art shows, but I never really pursued it. I always made art, but I never seriously pursued the art till after I graduated from graduate school, which was 2011. So I can't really speak to what it was like before or when I started, because I'm still kind of relatively new at this. But the one thing that I notice all the time is just to build real, authentic relationships with people, you know, to truly love what you do and to do it honestly and passionately, but to try to think about others as well, you know, kind of that old adage, be a good person, and to look for opportunities and to share opportunities with others, to have good working relationships with, you know, your nonprofits that you're showing at, with your collectors. Just to be a good person. So everything I've done from the heart, and so far it's worked well for me.
Well, I'll tell you why I asked that, Laura, because, you know, precisely at the moment that you begin entering the market, right, tail end of 2010, mm-hmm. beginning of 2011, is when we see the real rocket ship L-curve trajectory, the takeoff of social media. If you go back and look, there were still people before that, before 2011, that were saying what they said in mm-hmm. 2004 about email. I'll never use email. I believe in a personal relationship and a handshake. And of course, who's not using email now? How do I reach you without your email address? You know, do I send a pigeon or, you know, or a boy to run down the street and knock
at your door?
It doesn't happen. But in 2011, we began a different kind of conversation. And that conversation, that's when people started saying, look, you really can't do anything without social media. And that thing you just said about, it's about building sort of an authentic conversation. That's not how people talked prior to 2011. They, you know, they said a lot of things about marketing, but they didn't really use that sort of phraseology, you know, building an authentic conversation. And you flat out pulled it out of your hat there. So I'm really excited about it. So I want to ask you, is that awareness of that shift, or just you being, you emerging at the time of that shift? Has that shaped your marketing strategy? Has your marketing strategy involved social, or has simply that what we've learned from social involved, influenced your marketing?
Yeah, well, I guess I never realized that what the question was. I have a blog, so I write all the time about stuff. I've started to interview other artists. So yeah, I'm right there with social media. I guess I use it so often, I don't even think about it. I love Instagram. I constantly am posting not only my work on Instagram, but the things that I love, other images that I find exciting. I'm always looking for other quilters, fabric quilters. I'm looking at abstract artists on Instagram. That is sort of my go-to site to find friends. Facebook I use as well. Twitter, not so much, but I'm on there. And social media is just a way to connect to an audience specific to what you love. And this whole hashtag thing is the greatest thing in the world, because I can do a search with hashtag abstract artist 20th century. I get so many hits, and then I like the work. They follow me. I follow them. We start conversations emailing. I might interview them on my blog. They might contact me. It's really cool. I can travel across the United States in like a nanosecond through social media and make an audience that way and find my audience. You know, before you'd only hope to maybe find people in your community. Well, now my community extends worldwide because of social media.
You know, I love what you said about hashtag, because, you know, a lot of, you know, Clark Hewlings did a lot of work that we would classify as American realism. And you might think, well, you know, are you really going to find anything like that in social media and with hashtags? And in fact, if you search Google, you just put in hashtag American realism, the top results are Instagram, Twitter, and Pinterest, three social networks. And when you click on them, they are rife with some of the most cutting edge, latest work that's being done by successful working artists and emerging artists in American realism. So in every genre, social has really extended our ability to get access to the genre, to learn more about it, to find out what inspires us and what makes it tick, and to also meet the lady behind the popcorn or the apple pie, to really understand who is it that's making this art. And that brings me to another question. You know, so we had Stephen Zimmerman on an earlier episode. And for those of you that do listen to the show now and then and haven't listened to Steve's episode, I really would. It is about the perspective that collectors bring to this process. And it's really surprising and really unique. And so, Laura, I want to ask you, what, if anything, are you doing to build relationships with collectors? Do you find that, is that an easy thing to do? Is that really challenging? Do you have collectors taking an interest in your work? And what role does that play in your career?
I suppose a lot of my collectors now are my friends as well through social media. I've found some people have found my work through Instagram and have made sales through my work. I follow them and like their pictures and become part of their conversation in a digital world and a digital experience. And I mean, seriously, this one woman found my work. She lives in Indianapolis. And, you know, now we follow each other on Instagram. I don't know who she is in real life, but I feel like I have a relationship with her through social media. And that's really interesting. And a lot of my collectors are people that have found my work through the internet and have contacted me. Maybe they've had some relationship with Hurricane Sandy, or they have some relationship with quilts, or are woodworkers themselves and have found me through social media as well as through my shows. They've come to see my show at Salisbury University or at the James Michener Museum and have contacted me through email. So again, my collectors I've built a relationship with, and that's so pivotal because they do like the story about it and they've had a similar story as well. And we share that kind of collective experience.
I wonder if you can tell us what's happening with you and galleries.
Well, that's a really good question. Right now, I am interested in gallery representation. I don't have it, I show at a lot of nonprofits currently. And again, a real great story about making connections and using the internet and social media. An alma mater, an alumni of mine, works at the James Michener Museum. They had a show on quilts. I had written her and was hoping just to maybe get a VIP pass into the opening night. And it turns out that they had invited me to display 14 pieces of my work at the show called Pattern Pieces at the James Michener Museum. It was through this kind of connection and building relationships that afforded me this opportunity to exhibit my work there. And again, it was just reaching out to a community that might be interested in my work. It's just constantly making connections with somebody and being honest about that. Like, hey, you also went to Dickinson College? Me too. I like that you're working at James Michener, one of my favorite museums. A friend of mine showed there. And then making connections with people is how I've done what I've done to date. So I'm hoping to make more connections and make new friendships for gallery representation that way. And through, you know, real life friends as well, you know, not being afraid to ask my real life friends, hey, do you know anybody that might be able to introduce me to so-and-so because I would love to show at such and such a place. Do you know anybody? And not being afraid to ask, you know, my real life friends those questions as well. And that's how I'm doing it right now, through, I guess, good old-fashioned friendships.
Friendships and heels and shoes on the street, getting out there and doing some old-fashioned business networking. That's pretty impressive. So
yeah.
Let me has living and living and working in New Jersey, has being in that location affected your art or the trajectory of your career?
Yes, it has. I guess there's still a lot of prejudices, I guess, about New Jersey, but New Jersey is...
What, the shopping malls? Is that what we're talking about? There aren't that many shopping malls, and you don't hang art in shopping malls. Well, not your kind of art. They should, but they don't. If more people hung decent art in shopping malls...
I was thinking more like The Sopranos or The Jersey Shore, that reality show.
That's the best way to get your art, too. It's like, I got some art on the back of it. It fell off a truck, you know. It's, come here, it's in my trunk. You know, that's the way to get the art. You know, you get a better deal that way.
That's right.
Well, you should consider popping your truck sometime.
I love living in New Jersey. That's absolutely true. No, but New Jersey's great. I'm 50 miles from outside of New York City. I'm 88 miles from Philadelphia. My studio is my garage, so the rent is fantastic. It's pretty spacious. I mean, it's a, you know, 1.5-car garage where I have my wood shop out there, so I'm really thrilled with that. And I'm an hour away from New York City, so I'm able to go to the openings on Thursday nights and make connections that way in the city. And I'm far enough away that I, you know, don't have to pay through the nose for studio space as well. So for me, living in New Jersey is an ideal situation because of the proximity both to New York, Philadelphia, and even Boston. You know, I have a show at the end of the year in Providence, Rhode Island. I'll be able to take a train up there. I could take a train to Washington, D.C. So for me, the location is ideal because I have access to the major points in the northeast of this country.
Well, yeah, Jersey has a number of underrated gems, and I won't tell anybody what I think they are because I'm worried they'll all move there, and then they'll drive up the rent. So no, but yeah, I think that's fantastic. It is really central, and the cool thing is being in Jersey, there's no lack of good transportation access to the entire Eastern Seaboard. So yeah, I think that's important for somebody that's out there hoofing it, really growing a professional practice. So I'm going to ask you a couple of fun questions to wind down our show. So from the time that you first started, if you knew then in 2011 or even 2010, if you knew then what you know now, is there anything that you would go back and do differently?
Wow, that's a great question. I think I would not worry so much about all the rejections that you receive, I think I would have relaxed and said, oh my goodness, getting the thank you for applying, good luck in your future. Every artist gets them, and I don't think I would have worried so much about them as much, because at first they were really, really painful. But every artist has rejection, and you learn to live with it. And I don't think I would have been so sad and anxious about those had I known, you know, 5 years ago. I would have just chalked them up to, yeah, this is totally normal. Get used to it.
And if you could have one technology or superpower to do something that you simply cannot do currently with your art or career, what would you choose?
Oh, to clone myself. So I'd have two of me, an assistant and me. I would clone myself for sure. So I could get twice as much done.
Well, there you go. So we need a Laura Petrovich and a Laura Cheney to be Laura Petrovich Cheney. So now you see her and, oh, wow, you still see her no matter which way you turn. That would be,
that'd be
amazing. That would be an art, a feat of artistic achievement in and of itself. Well, you've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. To learn more about Laura Petrovich Cheney, visit laurachaney.com. Now, Laura's exhibition runs from January 15th through February 25th at the SU Art Galleries in Salisbury, Maryland. If you're on the Eastern Seaboard or have a friend or relative in Maryland, have them stop by the exhibition. The show runs from noon to 5 p.m. each day, and information is on the Clark Hulings Fund website. For more information on the fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org, and be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Laura. It's been really great having you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity and the grant.